Why have we been so easily duped by people like Stephen Glass, Janet Cook, Jason Blair, James Frey, and J.T. Leroy? Paul Malaszewski has written a book about deception in the arts and the people who practice it, called Fakers, Hoaxers, Con Artists, Counterfeiters, and Other Great Pretenders. It's published by the New Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Paul to the show. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
And you begin with a confession that you did a bit of conning yourself for a small business magazine.
Yes, after graduate school, one of my first jobs was working as a reporter for the business journal located in Syracuse. And I guess as a reporter, I did perfectly good work, but I became kind of increasingly upset at what the newspaper wasn't publishing, wasn't writing about. There was a Ponzi scheme that at the time was the largest Ponzi scheme in history. It's since been dwarfed by the Bernard Madoff scandal, but the newspaper didn't even assign a reporter to it, didn't write anything about it. So there were lots of stories that were just kind of slipping into the cracks. And so I did what any kind of upset reader would do. I wrote a letter to the editor, but wrote it under an assumed name.
Which you would have had to have done.
Exactly.
But then you started doing things that almost sound like April Fool's jokes, like the one that you wrote about the falling Dow under the name Gary Pike.
Right. Gary Pike was one of my frequent personas.
Didn't anybody get the pun about the Dow is silent? This is a basic tenet of Asian philosophy. You were spelling Dow, D-O-W, of course, but
right.
T-A-O is pronounced Dow as well.
I mean, that's one of the funny things about satire. I mean, I think there is in every satire a group of people who are in on the joke, who notice the puns, who get the kind of poke to the ribs and the wink, and then there are the people who just come and completely miss it.
But this is not anything that hurts anybody. If anything, you were just having fun.
Right.
Some of these other hoaxes have really hurt people because they have given us stories that are untrue and led people to come up with all sorts of follow-up stories. There have been prizes won by people who shouldn't have won prizes.
Sure.
There have been bestsellers sold under false names, false pretenses.
Right.
Did one thing, your thing, lead you to think about the bigger issue here?
I mean, one of the things that drove me, I think, was really the coincidence that while I was writing those satires, I was doing them at around the same time that Stephen Glass, the writer at the New Republic, who was fictionalizing, I think, as many as 40 articles for the magazine.
Well, 27 details in 27 articles is what he had copped to when he came on the show.
Okay.
some of them were totally invented. Some of them just had nice little details.
So, I mean, it was a coincidence, really, that we were both kind of working at the same time. And I remember thinking when he was discovered, oh, well, here's someone else working on a much bigger stage who is also writing satire. But I started to look into it and kind of found that there wasn't really a satiric motive.
No, he kind of admitted to just slipping into it because it led to more success. The same thing that Jason Blair did at the New York Times.
Right.
Could you have spotted, do you think anybody could have spotted that they were faked at the time?
I mean, I think in the case of Stephen Glass's fakes, they should have been spotted. I mean, I think one of the problems at the New Republic was their fact-checking consisted of taking the reporter's notes and just checking the reported piece against the notes and not actually making a call to any of the sources. So if the reporter just doctored the notes or concocted the notes as Stephen Glass did, then there was nothing to catch him.
But wasn't he also doing something quite clever, which is supplying the editors and readers with things they wanted to hear?
Exactly. I mean, I think that was his genius, if you can abuse that word. I think he took things that were just kind of conventionally talked about, the conventional wisdom, and just repackaged them with kind of colorful characters saying things that were a little bit crazy or a little bit funny, but the boats were not rocked when, you know, by Stephen Glass's stories. They just kind of fit very comfortably in with what you already knew.
Although some of them seem, in retrospect, to have been quite outrageous and unbelievable. And that is the thing, I guess, that surprises people the most. They look at them in retrospect and say, wow, how the heck could we have believed that?
Right.
The same sort of thing happens with Jan van Meegeren, the guy who convinced mostly, I guess, the Germans who were occupying the Netherlands at the time that he had come up with some early Vermeer paintings. You look at them today and There's no way that Vermeer could have painted those terrible paintings.
Right. I mean, yeah, the thing that's interesting about von Meegeren, I mean, he decided to forge paintings of a painter, first of all, who is widely respected and loved, but a painter who has only really given us about two dozen works of art. So there's an enormous need or a desire for more Vermeers. And, you know, the critics at the time had speculated, you know, what would these missing Vermeers look like if we ever saw them? Like, what might Vermeer's early period or middle period have been like? And so all van Meegeren did is essentially just tailor his work to what the critics had already been hypothesizing.
Did Janet Glass do pretty much Janet Cook, I mean, do pretty much the same thing that led to her winning the Pulitzer in 1981?
She was a reporter at the Washington Post. Her editor was Bob Woodward, and she wrote a piece that gained a lot of attention and, like you said, won the Pulitzer Prize. It was called Jimmy's World. It was a story about, I mean, it was a story really in the broadest sense about drugs in the inner city. Jimmy of the title was a very young kid. I believe he was 4 or 5 years old.
8 years old.
8 years old. Thank you.
He was a heroin addict.
Yes, a heroin addict. And that, I think what was stunning about it was just that this kid was so blasé about it and yet so young. You know, so I don't think there was anything kind of amazingly earth-shattering in it. You know, what was amazing about it was just that it was put into the mouths of this young child.
And people didn't question the fact that an 8-year-old would have to inject himself with heroin.
Right, right. The practical matters.
Another case is Jason Blair. Many alarm bells went off when Jason Blair wrote some of his things, and people started telling editors that he couldn't have been at some of the – he couldn't have witnessed some of the things he was writing about, and yet he got away with it for quite a while.
Right. I mean, I think one of the funny anecdotes that I came across with Jason Blair is that he – one of his beats was writing about Jessica Lynch, and he was kind of covering Jessica Lynch's family as they kind of waited to hear how their daughter was doing in Iraq, or whether she had been found. So he was supposed to be kind of trailing after the family, talking about them. He didn't, it turns out, ever go to West Virginia to meet with them. I don't even think he picked up the phone to call them. So all of his articles kind of contain the most kind of imaginative pastoral details about what their farm was like. And reporters later went back to the family and said, you know, what did you think when you picked up the New York Times and you read this about your farm and the cows that you own and all these things that just aren't true? And they just said that they laughed. They thought it was funny, and they thought that it just wouldn't happen again.
Well, in the case of the Times, they do have fact checkers, but it's been pointed out that some stories are just too good to check.
Right. I mean, that's the perfect phrase, really.
My guest is Paul Malachewski. His book, Fakers, Hoaxers, Con Artists, Counterfeiters, and Other Great Pretenders. It is published by the New Press. We've seen this sort of thing for a very long time. This sort of thing goes back centuries. Do you think that it comes out of some kind of a basic human impulse? Because they're going to be found. I can't imagine that any of the people who we've been talking about, whether it's Stephen Glass or Janet Cook or Jason Blair or James Frey or J.T. Leroy, mm-hmm. Imagine that they would get away with it forever. I mean, I've always wondered about people who do Ponzi schemes.
Right.
Somewhere along the line, this thing is going to come falling down on them. It always does.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what they think they're going to do. I mean, certainly if they're up on the history of fakers, they would know that it's all going to come tumbling down eventually.
Do you think that a Ponzi scheme is just another variant on what we've been talking about?
I mean, I one of the pieces that I wrote about deals with kind of the origins of the word con artist, and you know, the idea that con artist is really a shortened form of the word confidence. You know, I give you my confidence because I trust you to invest my money. So in a lot of ways, Ponzi schemes are a very elaborate, very kind of new form of that old, very old con. You know, here's someone who represents himself as a good investor, a solid investor, an investor who you know, as Bernard Madoff used to promise, can return 10% year in, year out, regardless of the market. And people trust that. You know, people give him their confidence. So it is age old in that respect. It's just multiplied, you know, by millions.
Well, we should be suspicious because it goes against all of what we know, and yet I guess we want to believe it. The same sort of thing happened for many people, not everybody, but in the lead up to the war in Iraq,
right.
The weapons of mass destruction, some people said this is unlikely to be the case. There have been inspectors out there, and they're pretty good at what they do. And yet newspapers, politicians, some of them, I've heard all of the things from the Congressional Record, they all got up there and they assured us that there was going to be a mushroom cloud if we didn't do something.
Right. I mean, I think the quote that I often think about when I think about the Iraq War is a very old quote from Samuel Johnson, and it came up in the context of one of the older hoaxes that I wrote about. And Samuel Johnson said that there's nothing a man won't believe if you repeat it to him for 365 days a year over breakfast. And I mean, I think that in its essence is the story of the Iraq War. You know, it's something, it's repeating the same lies, really, every day over breakfast in the newspaper until it sinks in.
Can you talk about some of the other hoaxes? For example, the Spectra hoax?
The Spectra hoax was it was an American hoax. It was around the kind of turn of the century, 1910s or so. It was two poets who got together in the Midwest and who invented a fake school of poetry known as Spectra. Their idea at the time was just to kind of lampoon modernism, really, modernist writing. They were traditional. They liked their poems to have meter and, you know, rhyme. So Spectre was just, it was gobbledygook if you go back and read the poems. And
although I did have somebody on the show many years ago who said, you know, some of these poems actually turn out to be pretty good.
I mean, it's the thing about it is that sensibilities change, you know, so our, you know, what we can admire about a piece of poetry changes.
You spoke to a few of the hoaxers. What did they tell you?
I mean, one of the hoaxers I spoke to, or I emailed with him, was Clifford Irving. He was the fellow who, in the 70s, invented or concocted the autobiography of Howard Hughes and made a lot of money for it. But probably of all the hoaxers that I read about, was punished the most severely. He did,
including having Richard Gere play him in a movie.
Yeah.
Which,
a lot of people
that's
don't
quite a bit
that
of punishment.
No, he did prison time in addition to having Richard Gere play him in the movie. And I mean, he was an interesting person to talk to. I mean, in some ways, I mean, I got the feeling that he was a person who, on one hand, would like very much to talk about any other period of his life, but everyone who contacts him wants to talk about 1971. But he's also exceedingly frustrating, I think, like a lot of the fakers, in terms of not being able to come up with an explanation for his motive. I mean, it was very hard. I asked him like 9 or 10 different ways, you know, why did you do this? I'm trying to understand why you would do this. I mean, much like you were saying, you know, why would anyone undertake this knowing that they're probably likely to get caught? And he could not come up with a good answer. In some ways, what he said was just, you know, any kind of attempt that I would make to talk about my motive would just be fiction.
But one of the things that drives many con men is the feeling that they're superior to others, that they're putting something over on the
right.
rest of us. And I'm sure that when everybody was all excited by his Howard Hughes material, he was just feeling like the smartest guy in the world.
Right. It must have been a thrill to pull that off.
I suspect that happens with most of these people.
I think so. I mean, I think that's right.
Although, as you point out, in a few cases, it was seen as a joke. The poetry was a joke. In the case of J.T. Leroy, there was no joke involved.
Right. And that
was complicated. They had to get somebody to play the guy. And
right. It was complicated. And of all these hoaxes, I mean, I think it ran for a long time. I mean, it was several years that they were able to kind of pull it off.
Oh, everybody believed that there was this young man who, with this tragic story.
Right.
And he was writing about a lot more than just his own life at a certain point. He had a whole career as a kind of a freelance journalist.
Right. No, he wrote for a lot of prominent places, music magazines, New York Times, New York Times Magazine. He was one of those reporters. And really, Stephen Glass was the same way in his heyday. You know, every editor wanted this writer in their pages.
Because they were hot?
He had a certain cachet, you know, and I think in the case of J.T. Leroy, it was this, you know, here was this individual who, you know, there was no other writer like him. He wasn't a middle class person. He hadn't gone to college. You know, it was a kind of impossible story in a lot of ways, but it was a story that made people feel good because here he is sitting before you, you know, having survived.
Is there an impulse to call this an American thing? Because quite a few of the hoaxes were not Americans. But is there a uniquely American aspect to this?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I talked to a reporter once in Ireland about this, and he was kind of fascinated by the fact that there were so many journalist hoaxes here. And he had kind of told me that he had considered faking to be almost strictly something that happened in the art world, you know, the painting. But, yeah, I'm not sure it's necessarily American.
Well, because of our popular culture, it's easier to do it here, as we just saw in a situation that happened after I'm sure your book went to press, with the Holocaust memoir that Oprah Winfrey had been promoting.
Herman Rosenblatt.
And that has shocked a lot of people because so many people wanted to believe.
Right. No, I mean, I think that's a key to a lot of these stories. You know, the stories that they're telling are something that people dearly want to hear. And in the case of a lot of the Holocaust memoirs, I mean, they're memoirs written by people who are ostensibly written by people who survived the Holocaust, which people want to hear anyway. But oftentimes they involve childhood. In the case of, you know, the Rosenblatt memoir that you're talking about, you know, he's writing about his childhood.
Paul Malachewski will be speaking with critic Eric Banks tonight at 7 o'clock at the McNally Jackson Bookstore at 52 Prince Street. The book is called Fakers, Hoaxers, Con Artists, Counterfeiters, and Other Great Pretenders. It's from the New Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.